just singing. We were singing, Yeshua is our everything. The your everything. And more? More than everything? What does that mean that he is our or your everything? Does that leave anything out? If he's your everything, does that mean is everything you are and everything you have and everything you think about and plan, is that his then? Is that the way it works? Feel free to answer out loud. Lord, I ask you for your help, Lord. I ask you to help all of us. And I thank you for what you've done for us in Yeshua. Father, I just ask that you bless each person here, that you speak to them, show them your love in a deeper way, no matter how much of it we've experienced. Father, I ask you to come by your Spirit and touch us, touch our hearts, touch our minds, touch the places where we're troubled or confused, and touch the places where we have wounds that cause us to not to see clearly. Help us to see you. Help us to see Yeshua with all authority over everything in heaven and earth, and to come to a place of trust and equilibrium because of who he is and what he's done and who he's made us to be. And please help me, Lord, right now to share things that are from your heart that will build up our hearts in Yeshua's name. So, anybody read the Torah portions? These are some of my favorite things, you know, scabs, boils, strange spots in the skin with different colored hair coming out of them, what to do about them. You know, I was reading something in a commentary in a Chumash this morning that said how hard it is for us in the modern times to think about these things and think that anything's unclean. And of course, whenever I read commentary like that, I think, oh, I guess maybe I'm different then. I've just never really had too much trouble thinking about things being unclean. I don't know. I guess I was raised differently than most people, but what do you think? Do you think people, even people that that have no instruction, have no theology they're aware of, never heard any verse from the Bible, do you think people like that just think everything's clean? You think all those people feel clean? Do you? What do you think? No. Do Hindus feel clean? Do pariahs feel clean? That's the lowest of the Hindus, right? It's the name I named myself with respect to reaching out to the Jewish people. It was this expression of attitude, not condemnation. That and it probably comes to bear. Is anyone here want to reach anyone that's lost with the gospel? A few of us? Those who definitely don't, please raise your hand. Okay, I'll take that as a yes from everybody. It, I've been learning about this my whole life. I'm afraid I still have a lot to learn. But have you ever decided actively that there was some group or some individual that you actually wanted to communicate a message to? You want to communicate to them, and you want them to understand what you are communicating. Have you ever set out to do that with an individual or a group of people or anything?
Not even once.
Not even once? Wow. It, you know, when I was in graduate school with a bunch of artists, I don't know who has the biggest egos in the world, guitar players, sculptors, painters. In the art world, I guess the group that painters exist in seem to have the idea that they are far above everyone else. But then sculptors can think that they're wrong and think that sculptors are more important than anybody on the face of the earth. But at any rate, it suffices to say that pretty much anybody, at least if they're in graduate school, has some kind of an ego, or they wouldn't be in graduate school. And so they all have something they want to say. They don't all know what they want to say. Some of them just think they have something to say, but every one of them, almost all of them, think that it is a responsibility of other people to appreciate and understand what they are doing. That it is not their responsibility to get their message across to the people they chose to communicate something to. And I know this because I noticed it, but then I know it even more because I began to argue it. I began to say, you know what? Because I heard people say things like, well, the people have a responsibility to educate themselves so that they can understand, you know? And I don't think any of them ever suggested that if an artist wanted to communicate something, that if there was something missing, that he needed to educate the people. But see, I don't really even believe that, because it's just so arrogant to me. It's like, I have something to say, so then I'm going to go educate you so that you can understand what I'm saying. I mean, talking to someone and explaining and giving information if they want to hear you, that's one thing. But the expectation is that I'm important, I got great things to say, I'm better than other people because I'm an artist, and they should endeavor to appreciate and understand me, if not bow down to me. So I argued that, look, if you have something to say, there's a group of people you want to say it to. It is your responsibility to find out what their language is. And then you need to learn their language. And then you need to figure out how you get what you want to say across to them. It's all on you. And if they come and look at what you've done and they don't get it and they don't appreciate it, then, you know, I mean, there could be flaws in individuals that look at things, but I always figured, see, I failed if whatever it was I was trying to say did not come across. It was my responsibility. If they didn't know what I was trying to say, my responsibility. And that didn't seem to be very popular. But in a world where some people who are good craftsmen choose to make like vessels that would hold things and put a hole, at least one hole somewhere toward the bottom, to make sure that it isn't actually useful. See, then it's not functional. There was this notion, if it's functional, it's either not really art or it's not high art. See, but if you poke a hole in it and it's beautiful, see, then it's high art because it's not functional. And, you know, you could get a little sick in some of these situations talking with a bunch of artists. And then I met people. I had a required course. It was called Art in Contemporary Culture, and the professor was very, very bitter, very, very cynical, old modern artist who I really liked, and you can probably tell why I liked him. He was old, bitter, and cynical. And, well, I don't know if that's exactly why I liked him. But the thing is, he kind of told the truth. He was kind of dangerous. But he asked questions, and one time he asked a question. This is a group of, you know, it's not just people from the program I was in. Who in the room thought they were better than other people because they were an artist? Now, I don't know if I was shocked, but some of them put their hands in the air. And whether I don't recall if I was, I mean, I've known a lot of art students, so it's hard to be shocked by some things, but I just thought, wow, they're willing to express it in front of a group of people because they're an artist. They're actually more important than other people. And then, like, how much more important? Well, one guy was willing to go so far as to even compare himself to his own brother, who was a mechanic. And then he goes, and I think I'm better than him. Well, and then I saw some of his work. And it was a bad rehash of old modern art stuff. I mean, there was nothing. It had no vibrancy. There was nothing attractive. It wasn't new. He didn't even put a new tinge on it or a twist. It was just bad. But based on that, he believed he was better. So it seems to me when I look around, even if people aren't artists, they're looking for something to find. They can say they're valuable because of it. Some of them want to be better than everybody else. Some of them just want to matter. They just want to be sure they actually matter. But at any rate, I maintained all the way through and still do that if you want to communicate to somebody, an individual or group, can be very frustrating, can be very tempting to put the responsibility on them if they didn't understand. I think it's just wrong. If you want to communicate with someone or a group, you have to understand them. You have to understand how they talk. You have to know something about how they think. And you have to invest yourself in getting the message across if it matters. And that involves suffering for the sake of communicating. And so that's why I designated myself a pariah if I was going to go try to reach the Jewish people, because I thought, well, hey, I mean, I'm not a Hindu, I never will be, but that's like really low. So if I accepted that I was scorned, I expected some would scorn me. I'm not saying that I thought of myself this way or that I expected everyone would hate my guts, but I thought, wait, now see, I think I'm going to go communicate to some people. I think I'm supposed to do that. It's supposed to have something to do with God's love shed abroad in my heart, well, in yours too. So, let's see. What should I expect of them? Nothing. I should expect nothing of them. I mean, in terms of thinking that I have a right, that something comes from them to me, nothing. It's harder to be disappointed when you have no expectations. Have you ever noticed that? If you've never had no expectations, try it sometime. And let me know if you actually pull it off. It can be really difficult. So anyway, I thought, okay, I'm a pariah, but I wanna add an objective. I wanted to move from one station to another. So what I wanted to be, I'm a pariah. No, it's worse. It was an irrelevant pariah. Because I think a pariah within Hinduism at least has some relevance in Hinduism. But I'm an irrelevant pariah. So my objective was to become a irrelevant pariah, you know. Still a pariah. Don't have to want anyone to congratulate me or tell me how great I am, but at least relevant. And then from there I wanted to go to, this was not at all what I was going to say when I got up here. I think it's related. Our pariah, yeah, that's two big steps, irrelevant to relevant. relevant pariah to our pariah. That means I would belong to the group that I went to, even though I was still a pariah. And then, and if you don't understand that, you just need to understand the concept of the village idiot. Because the village idiot has a sad but important function. He gets picked on by everybody. And it may actually even make him feel belonging, because it's like they care enough at least to pick on him and make light of him, and he sort of belongs there and he serves a function. But I mean, it's not that much fun necessarily. But the thing about a village idiot, if you've ever noticed, is if somebody from outside picks on the village idiot, that's our idiot, and you don't touch him. You don't do that to our, that's our idiot. We'll protect our idiot, see? So you get what I'm saying? It's a certain belonging. It's not the highest station. But then Messiah didn't come to have the highest station himself, and he does have the highest station, and he didn't come to sit in it. He came to serve other people. He came to communicate with them. He was exalted. He was pure. I mean, he got down in the muck. He went had lunch with prostitutes, and even worse, I think, tax gatherers who extorted money on behalf of an occupying nation from their own people. So, you know, he communicated with people. He got down on their level. He spoke with little kids. Actually suggested that we all need to be like that. So, anyway, what I discovered over time, you know, if you spend time with people, it's likely you may begin to understand some things about them. And they also may begin to understand some things about you, especially if you don't push, especially if you leave your agenda in the glove box in your car, and then maybe even throw it in the trash at some point when you go back to your car and realize, oh, I shouldn't have had it at all. It's not even that I should leave it outside. I just didn't have one. And then throw it away and just be a human being and just try to relate to them. And so when some things sort of wear away and they start to know who you are and you know something about who they are, and you may have thought you did when you went there, but you find out you didn't know anything, then it becomes possible sometimes to actually communicate with people. But you have to, you earn it. You really have to earn it, especially when you're a suspect to begin with. And I accepted that I was those things. I expected to be suspect. I didn't even blame anybody for thinking of me that way. And I told some of them so. Because, well, I wanted to be as honest as possible, so wherever it was appropriate, I would say whatever. So, so what were we talking about? We were talking about boils and pimples and white patches in the skin. And, oh, yeah, so what I think I've noticed in my life is that in the modern age, people don't feel clean. If they read Leviticus, they might make fun of it and say, oh, it's just a bunch of, you know, I don't know, whatever. But I don't know. I've met a lot of people I've met, and I don't, it just seems like an awful lot of them don't feel clean at all. Some of them will tell you about it, about their shame, about the things they can't get wiped off of them. Some of them just look like it. You can just feel it looking at them. They don't feel clean. They may deny that there's any such thing as a clean animal or an unclean animal, or that touching anything could ever do anything, or that, but they don't feel clean. And a lot of them are willing to talk about it if they sense the person they're talking to understands who they are, can hear their language, and isn't there to try to muck around and fix them or change them into what they think they should be. So, one thing I figured about artists when I was in graduate school was that to really communicate something, an artist probably needs to know who they are. You think you need to know who you are to communicate to other people? How well can we communicate to people that need to hear the gospel if we're not sure who we are? If we're not sure what we have? Or am I speaking to the choir? Or only to myself? Wait, if I am speaking to the choir, then who am I speaking to? You nodded your head, but I just realized I'm not sure if I know who I'm speaking to. If I'm speaking to the choir, how many of you are in the choir? What? Yeah, so, and then I lost my train of thought. What did I say right before I asked that question? Yeah. Do we always know who we are when we're telling somebody what we believe the truth to be? You ever try to tell someone the gospel when you're feeling really guilty? Does it have any effect on what you say? Yeah. I mean, theoretically, you could possibly say all the same things you would have said if you weren't feeling guilty, but is the message changed by the fact that you feel guilty? Anybody here ever felt guilty when you weren't guilty? Yeah, I know all about false guilt. I've also felt very guilty when I was very guilty. But they are different things. But if something's disturbing you, disturbing your peace, affecting your confidence, can you be feeling guilty and be disturbed about things that aren't, I mean, it within yourself, I mean, things about you? How clear can you be about what you need to say to somebody if there's something causing you uneasiness about the very thing you're talking about? Wouldn't it affect how clear you are? So, I've seen a number of commercials that have psoriasis in them. And they've gotten more emotional than they once were. They include things like someone saying in a sort of a sad voice that, I'm not contagious. And you know, I've never had psoriasis, but you know, some people have it really badly. And it affects them. People look at them. People stay farther away from them. And the one commercial I've seen, it really makes me think about humanity. There are people, they don't feel like they're a part of the community. They feel like they're rejected. They feel like people don't even want to be that close to them. And I could see the pain. The commercial did a pretty good job showing the pain. And they didn't pick the most pretty people with psoriasis for the commercial either. I thought they all looked like, you know, blazingly human and in God's image, but the thing is they didn't try to pick pretty people. So, the commercial, of course, is trying to cause someone with that to feel hope that life can be different because of a product they're selling. And it probably does help people, But the thing is, the pain and the distance and the wanting to be accepted, the wanting to belong, the wanting to be able to approach and not feeling like you're welcome, you know, it's a pretty hard thing. But, you know, people that look perfectly normal can feel that way and stay away, even though there's nothing anybody can see. And to my great surprise, a couple years ago, after a tragic accident killed one of my friends, there was a woman at this thing after the funeral, and none of these people, almost none of them, were believers. And when she got up and spoke about the deceased, she actually mentioned the thought that she felt that she would be rejected by the deceased and other people in the group because she had been divorced. And that, frankly, it shocked me. So, because I guess people feel like they're duds, like they don't matter because something's gone wrong in their life. But I thought, really, I actually couldn't really imagine that there were many people there that would have rejected anyone based on that. Maybe I'm wrong. But what I could see was her sense of shame, and what she was noting was that she had felt accepted, and that's a really good thing to feel accepted, isn't it? So in the body of Messiah, I don't know. I think when I come in here, I feel accepted. Do you? I hope anybody that comes in the door here feels accepted. When you look in the eyes in the mirror, you always feel accepted? I mean, when there's not anybody else standing behind you. When you just see yourself, do you feel accepted when you look in the mirror? It's a good thing to look in the mirror and see someone that completely accepts you. But a lot of people don't see someone like that in the mirror. And I'm pretty convinced that the most complete and only full way to completely accept the person that's gazing from or into the mirror is to have Yeshua have changed your life, redeemed you, given you a new one. So, anyway, I was thinking about what people expect. And you know, this passage, well, it didn't actually, I don't think we actually read the part just before it, but in 2 Kings, I think the passage that was read might have started right after this, but 2 Kings 7, 1, it says, "But Elisha said, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, tomorrow about this time, a seah of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel, and 2 seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria. Then the captain on whose hand the king leans said to the man of God, if the Lord himself should make windows in heaven, could this thing be? But he said, you shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat of it." I was wondering, it's kind of figurative, but when you look up into heaven, what do you see? You see the windows of heaven open? Or do you see a bunch of locked shutters? What do you see? If the Lord spoke really, really good things to you, would you say, I don't know, if the windows of heaven would open, could that happen? What's your answer? I'm curious. What would you say? Can't hear you. If the Lord spoke really, really good things to you, but what's coming? Can you imagine yourself looking up to heaven and saying, I don't know. Even if you open up all the windows up there, I don't think that could happen, or what would you say? What? I was expecting at least two people to say, the Lord has spoken really good things to me. What are you talking about if? He has already spoken really, really good things to you. And so I want to know what you're expecting. He's spoken really, really good things to you. Are you looking up and saying, it's all shuttered up. The heaven is brass. I can't even get through it. Nothing's coming down. Or are you expecting that the windows of heaven have been opened, good things are going to come down? are going to shower down upon you. What are you expecting? Now I'm going to jump all the way. I know you've already figured out where I'm going. Right? Yep. John chapter 11. I knew it. I'm so predictable. I'm going to read you part of it. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. I should have said Miriam, but then I should have said something else for Martha then. How do you say Martha in Hebrew? It was Miriam who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet. Wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." But when Yeshua heard it, said, "This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Now Yeshua loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Is this a curious passage? Does it sound like he said he wasn't going to die, doesn't it? This illness does not lead to death. You hear a true statement there or a false statement? Did Lazarus die? Oh wait, forget that. Did Yeshua raise him from the dead?
Yeah.
Okay, but he didn't die, right?
Only briefly.
Briefly. Long enough that there would be a stench. How brief? Okay, so when he heard he was ill, see, he loved all three of them. So when he heard he was ill, he waited 2 more days to go there. Then after this, he said to his disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Judeans were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again?" Yeshua answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him." After saying these things, he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him." The disciples said to him, "Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he'll wake up." Now Yeshua had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking rest and sleep. Then Yeshua told them plainly, "Lazarus has died, and for your sake I am glad that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him." So Thomas said, Thomas called the twins, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." Now when Yeshua came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Miriam to console them concerning their brothers. So when Martha heard that Yeshua was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. I'm going back and forth between Mary and Miriam now. Martha said to Yeshua, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Yeshua said to her, "That sounds like somebody that has expectations. Somebody that at least knows what she could expect, because she knows who she's talking to." That's what it sounds like to me. Whatever he asked, the Lord would give him. Yeshua said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Yeshua said to her, "I am the resurrection. I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. and everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." So, anyway, you know that after this, more happened. There's a little bit of discussion. And Lazarus gets raised from the dead, right? Do I need to read it? I was trying to imagine after that, and it must be unusual to be somebody that was dead and in the tomb for a few days and then be walking around again. It must, it's hard for me to imagine what it feels like. Or is it? Is it? Should it be? Maybe. But I was trying to imagine Lazarus and how he lived the rest of his life. And I wondered if he ever walked around doubting, like, "Oh, well, you know, if I'd actually been raised up, maybe I could go do that thing or take care of this, but I don't know, I'm not sure if I'm really alive." Can you imagine that? I can too. Is it hard for, I mean, we have different types of imaginations here and different experiences. What? But Lazarus was actually he wasn't only mostly dead. He was dead. His sister says, "I don't know if you want to go too close. He's going to stink." And he raised up from the dead. I was just trying to imagine him walking around, acting and thinking like he hadn't been raised from the dead. You all know where I'm going, don't you? Don't you? It's obvious, see, because I'm very predictable. You always know what I'm going to say next. So, where am I going? No! Wait, what? Say that again.
We have been raised from the dead.
We have been raised from the dead. Well, if we've been raised from the dead, we shouldn't walk around thinking maybe we haven't been. Thinking, well, maybe we're not really alive. Well, maybe I don't really have abundant life available to me or in me. Maybe I'm a dud. Maybe it didn't work. Maybe I'm not really raised. And the more layers you get to it, it's like you can accept all of the verses at the same time. That something in you, both feeling, emotion, and reason, all kind of mixed in a certain potion, acts like it's not really true. And if you're going to tell other people the truth, you actually need to practice telling yourself the truth. And it's really good to get to the point when you tell yourself the truth that you hear amen come from the audience. Because if the audience doesn't say amen when you're talking to yourself about who you are and what has been done for you, I gotta tell you, and I've said it with bitter feeling to a couple of people in my life, don't expect anyone to listen to your message. If you're stuck there, I want you to have a little bit of hope, because I know a preacher's kid. He was recalcitrant. He was, if you don't know what that word means, it just means bad. It's like reprobate. It's like lost again if it's possible to be lost. And if it's not possible to be lost, well, really bad, in a really, really bad condition, in total rebellion, drinking, all kinds of bad stuff. You can probably fill in the blanks. And he'd be in bars, and he'd talk to people, and they would come to faith. Because he had the truth in him, and he couldn't seem to stop himself from saying it. But, you know, that's not the best witness in the world. When somebody that's in a putrid state tells the truth and somebody comes to faith, well, that's just proof that the word is active and sharp and better than any two-edged sword, that it can just slice through all the junk in people and show them who they are and who God is at the same time. And it probably preaches right back to the backslidden person that, hey, what are you doing here? Get back to your Father's house. That's where you belong. You've forgotten who you were. But you know, when you know who you are and you're sure of it, and you don't think maybe it didn't work, and you don't have so much faith in your own imperfection as to suggest to yourself that maybe it didn't really work for you, that maybe God's power isn't really real for you, that maybe it's real for other people, but it doesn't seem to do that in you. I lost it again. See, then you can look somebody in the eye and tell them the truth. Look right into their eyes and not flinch and not feel like you have to look away, and tell them the truth. And they can look right into the windows of your soul and see a flawed but honest person who's been purified, who has confidence, who knows who their father is and who their brother is. And if you don't know who that is, that's Yeshua. So they can look someone in the eye and tell them the truth. That doesn't mean the person looking back has to accept it. But see, if they reject it, it's Yeshua they're rejecting. It's not personal, even if they get personal. I've been introduced to people as an idol worshiper. I didn't take it personally. I've been standing in places talking to people where so-and-so walks up and says, he thinks God is a man. And I didn't take it personally. I've had people say, has God wore diapers? And some of these things, you know, did they hurt me? Yeah, I felt pain, but it wasn't personal. It was like they're insulting my Heavenly Father. They're insulting Yeshua. It's not about me. I wish I could say that there's never been any times where I reacted in a bad way where it wasn't like that. I wish I could say that. But the thing is when you know who you believe in, and you are persuaded that he is able to keep what you have committed to him until the end, until the last day, until the judgment and the time when the age to come arrives, then it's a lot of things are settled. And so I was thinking about Lazarus, and I was thinking for people who have come to faith in Yeshua to walk around like that would be just as preposterous as Lazarus walking around telling people that he was still in a tomb. You get my point? You don't have to say it. You can feel it and then end up acting like that's the case. But people figure it out. People need to see life. And what is it, the one thing I didn't mark? Ephesians 2, it says, "And you were dead. You were dead in the trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience, and among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath like the rest of mankind. But God, being rich in mercy, because of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with Messiah. By grace you have been saved, and raised up with him and seated. And by grace you have been saved and raised us up with him and seated us with him in the heavenly places in Messiah Yeshua, so that in the coming ages he might show the immeasurable riches of his grace and kindness towards us in Messiah Yeshua. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that is not your own doing. It is a gift of God, not a result of works, so that no one may boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Messiah Yeshua for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them." I feel like I need to finish up. This is, Paul says this about himself. "I have been crucified with Messiah. It is no longer I who live, but Messiah who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. I do not nullify the grace of God, for if justification were through the law, then Messiah died for no purpose." So Paul, he's a really, really notable, fabulous example of a religious Jewish man and a rabbi. Finds that what he needed was to die, to be crucified with Messiah, and that Messiah raised him up to new life and made it possible for him to live that new life, holding his head up because God had raised up his head, and speaking the truth to other people and bearing fruit. So I think that it's possible to get to a point where you're demoralized and you don't expect much. And at the point where that windows in heaven thing happens in Kings there that we read from, that's kind of where Israel was at. And I may be mixing things together, but I think it was previous to that. It'll work out. But there's this guy that gets raised when he comes into contact with Elisha's bones. And it wasn't Elisha that raised him. It was a reminder of the prophecies of victory over the Syrians that God had given to Israel through Elisha, but they weren't really expecting much. And it's possible to have promises, to have prophecies, to have all the promises in here, which we have, and get to a point where we just don't think that even if the windows of heaven opened all the way up, that what we long for and pray for is actually going to happen. It could be as big as the world or as small as one person, but we can get to where we no longer have expectation. And it simply the Lord's telling us to expect Him to do what He's promised. And I want to encourage you to revisit the things that He's promised you and the things that you know to be true, and reaffirm with Him, between you and Him, and tell it to somebody else that you're expecting Him to do what He said He will do, that you believe He's going to take care of the things He said He would take care of, that you believe that life reproduces itself, that there will be a harvest. And, you know, we ought to have joy. We ought to be glad. We ought to be going around saying, so. And then people would look at you funny, and if they're not clear out, they'll say, what are you talking about? And you say, well, the scriptures say, let the redeemed of the Lord say, so. And I am redeemed. And so I'm saying, so. So what about that? So what about the devil? So what about the naysayers? So what about the Democrats and the technocrats and the Republicans and the libertarians and the Hindus and the Islamic terrorists? And so what? I'm looking up. I get everything. I got my eyes fixed on Yeshua. None of it matters. You know who you belong to. You can go to Him. Bring it all to Him. And if you have a burden, the scriptures say you can cast it upon Him, for He cares for you. That means you don't have to drag it around like a ball and chain. I'm done. Let's just gather together and just thank the Lord for what He's given us and ask Him. Just ask Him to help us stay where we belong in the truth.